Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, the 25th of November, 2012. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Support for KUAF comes from To Enjoy Magazine, a monthly publication offering local arts, culture, and entertainment. The second annual Crystal Bridges Museum commemorative issue is now available. To Enjoy thanks everyone for their positive response over the past 3 years. Subscriptions and more information are available at 464-8900 or numeral 2 njoymag.com.
Ahead on Ozarks, a very special kind of rug making. Plus, Becca Martin Brown tells us what's up with shopping for crafts this holiday season.
But first, since 1986, the Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center has provided no-cost health services to uninsured and working poor adults in the area. For the past 24 of those years, the center has been in the Armory Building next to the old Washington County Courthouse. That space has been adapted over the past quarter century to accommodate more clients and more professional volunteers. But the need for such services continues to grow with the region's population, and soon the Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center will be in a new, larger, freshly remodeled home.
We're basically the safety net. People have no other way to go, and we try to help in many areas. We try to be as comprehensive as possible.
Monica Fisher-Massey is the executive director of the Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center. She's been at the center for 11 years, and during her tenure, the center has expanded its hours of service from being open 2 days a week to its current 5 days and one evening per week schedule. There are more professional volunteers, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and dentists than ever before, about 75. But still, the need for medical service outstrips the capacity of the current center.
If somebody asks me how we're doing, I always say our business is booming. We never lack for patients.
In 2000, the center had 2,000 patient visits. Last year, that number was 11,500 visits. Many of the clients not only have opportunities to see medical and dental personnel they wouldn't otherwise have access to, but they can take advantage of classes for such specific topics as diabetes or nutritional cooking. The Armory, where the center has been since 1988, has about 6,000 square feet. The new location will provide about 10,000 square feet.
And that's why we are moving to expand our services. We will be open more hours, plus we will nearly double the number of rooms that we have.
Last week, John Moores, the center's director of development, opened a side door to enter what will soon be the new Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center.
Main entrance will be here. When you first come in, the registration and reception area will be here, with a little seating area here for folks waiting to go to the reception desk. And that's the pharmacy. Another little waiting area here so people can wait while their prescriptions are getting ready.
The new center isn't far from the current downtown location. The building was most recently the Washington Regional Center for Exercise, a gym that had an open floor plan to accommodate weight machines, rowing machines, and treadmills. Now there are walls in that space that define waiting rooms, examination rooms, and offices. Those new facilities can handle more clients and make room for more volunteers. There will be twice as many medical examination rooms and twice the number of dental exam rooms. But John Moores acknowledges that means more expenses in the future, and he's been asked about sustaining the center.
We say all we can tell you is that we've been here for 26 years in this community. We've grown, but each year that we've grown and had an increased need for support, the community has always been there. So can I guarantee the future? No, but can I predict, I hope confidently, on the past 26 years of history is, yes, what we need. The community has been there for us, and we expect that to continue.
John Moore says the project's architect, Marlon Blackwell, has set a comfortable tone that should place clients and volunteers alike in a calm state. The new spot will increase the free parking for patients from about a half dozen spaces at the current location to about 70. The new center is easily accessible to a bus stop at the adjacent Veterans Administration campus. Also adjacent to the new location is the Northwest Arkansas campus of the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, a facility that can potentially provide more volunteers like medical and pharmaceutical students. The move to a new location needed many things to become reality, including volunteers. Volunteers, both medical professionals and laypeople, are so important because, remarkably, the Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center operates with 2 full-time and 8 part-time employees. As the population has boomed in Northwest Arkansas in the 26 years of the health center's existence, the need for the center's services has grown, too. John Moore says depending on the research you use, the number of uninsured adults in Benton and Washington counties is placed between 40 and 50,000 men and women.
One of our services, in addition to providing the medical and dental, meeting those needs of our patients, we have what's called a patient advocate position. And that position has two primary responsibilities. One is to find referrals to specialists for things that we can't treat here. If somebody needs a service or a specialty treatment like surgery or some other health care that we can't provide to our volunteers, then that's what she does. She finds the referrals. The other thing she does is to find medications for the patients who can't afford them. And I think we've all seen the commercials on TV that say, if you can't afford this medication, please call this number. Well, that's a patient assistance program to help people with their drugs that are really expensive. In 2011, we provided 5 drugs to patients that if they were have to be purchased in the local drugstore, would have cost over $350,000 just for those 5 medications for those patients who needed those medications in 2011. So it's just amazing what goes on sort of behind the scenes. People know that we provide medical care and dental care, but those kind of services tend to fly under the radar. But without those kinds of those results from our patient advocates' efforts, boy, it's just amazing.
The construction phase of the new center is expected to be completed sometime next month. The plan is to be able to stage the complicated move of the files, equipment, and furniture in one weekend. Close the doors on Friday evening. Be ready to see patients the following Monday. For Monica Fisher-Massey, the executive director at the Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center, this pending move is helping a dream come true. She says it's a dream that's reinforced every day she's worked at the center for the past 11 years.
When I come to work and patients come in, I walk through the lobby and I see such a great need, and that reminds me of what my needs and what my wants are. What I have wants, not needs. The basic needs are filled. Those of our patients are not.
You can learn more about the Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center at nwafreehealthcenter.org.
Boonville, Arkansas has a population of just over 4,000. In 2011, they were a volunteer community of the year. In the early 20th century, Boonville was one of few towns in the nation to house a tuberculosis sanatorium. Today, that same location is home to many individuals, but through the Boonville Human Development Center. The clients there make over 600 rugs a year through the organization's Rugs Project. The rugs are sold at craft fairs across the region. I visited the BHDC earlier this month. In the year 1910, a steel banner connected 2 large rock posts at the bottom of a drive. It read, Arkansas Tuberculosis Sanatorium. Back then, there was no cure for TB, and passing through this gate was a death sentence. Between 1910 and the early 1970s, over 70,000 patients moved through these brown, native rock columns. Patients were kept isolated from the rest of society. This Boonville location was ideal because it was up in the hilly woods. The sanatorium ran like a mini city, complete with a hospital, fire department, freestanding homes, and a school.
This building was built by the Masons in Arkansas.
That's John Carter, a residential services manager for the Boonville Human Development Center, or the BHDC.
To house the children on the tuberculosis sanatorium grounds. So this was a school for children. You'll see a stage in the weaving room where they would have school plays and things like that. So this was a very interesting building with a lot of history, I think.
When a cure for TB was found in the early 1970s, the sanatorium closed. It didn't take long for the BHDC to find a use for the property, moving in their first patient in 1972. The location now serves as a home and training facility for developmentally disabled adults, one in five state-run centers in Arkansas. Debbie Hill is a rehabilitation instructor supervisor.
It's just providing ways to help them grow and become as much as they can be, no matter whatever the disability might be.
Disabilities include various developmental issues and psychological, including bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. Patients or clients come here for a variety of reasons. Perhaps their behavioral issues are too difficult for families to handle, or the families themselves are aging and are no longer physically able to care for their loved ones. Debbie has been with BHDC for 25 years. Though when she started as a temporary teaching assistant, she thought she'd only be here 6 months. She says she got hooked on the clients.
And 25 years later, I'm going, why am I still here? And they're why I'm still here. Because I do enjoy working with them. I mean, anytime it can be stressful or it can be a little tense and stuff, but overall, they're a lot of fun. They're great people. I enjoy working with them. I used to make the mistake of saying anybody could work here. You know, I mean, it's a piece of cake. Anybody could work here. But not everybody can, and not everybody should.
Debbie now works in the Masonic building we mentioned earlier. It is in this former school building where the RUGS Project takes place, a pre-vocational training program the BDHC has been doing for 30 years. About 35 clients work here Monday through Friday. They have a literal job to do, making rugs.
It's not necessarily a job per se that they can go out in the community and do, but it's learning how to work with others. It's learning how to get along. This may not be your best friend, but I have to work with them and I have to show them respect as they show me respect. Learning how to do a task and to follow through and to stay on task, you know, during that work period, and knowing when to take your breaks and things. So all part of it is kind of work ethics that you need to learn in order to have a job outside of this facility.
The rugs they make here are pretty nice, sold to the public. More on that in a bit. They are made from loopers, as Debbie calls them. She had to explain further. When the toe of a sock is sewn together, there is excess fabric that has to be cut off. The result is a sock loop, a circle of material about 2 inches long. A sock factory in Fort Payne, Alabama, gives them to the BHDC Rugs Project. They only have to pay for the shipping. There are many steps involved in rug making. Clients receive individualized care and attention to find which job is right for them.
We sit down, we give one-on-one instruction on how to do a task, and then we back off and kind of let them do it. And we set the objective based on, are they easily distracted? You know, is it maybe just staying attentive, you know, staying on task? And we'll work on those things, things that will help them develop longer period of times of being able to focus on what they're doing at the moment. We help them also by, you know, we might try and take away some of the distractions. If they're distracted and look out a window, maybe we could move their workspace a little way. So we find different ways that will help them be successful. But we base it on what they can already do, and then we sit down and we show them and help teach them how to do the things that we want them to do.
Groups of workers are set up in the former classrooms. The BHDC also does recycling, picking up paper and cardboard from local schools. So some clients are tearing and sorting magazines. In one classroom, others are sorting the loopers, picking the bad ones out. They get paid for the work that they do, paid by the pound of sock loops they sort. Today, they are working with nylon loops, like from pantyhose. Other workers are tying the loops together to form long chains. Debbie explains.
And he's double tying. Because of it being nylon, it's kind of thin. And so we figured with double tie, then we'd have a much thicker and it'd be easier to weave and make a much nicer rug.
So it has two loops put together.
Yeah.
Instead of one.
So he takes two loops at a time and loops them and ties them into the other one, makes a long chain, and then rolls that up into a ball so that it can go to the weavers, and then they weave it. And so we'll show you how to do that here in a little bit. But they're cleaning and sorting loops right now, and he's tearing paper for the recycling.
We move to a room across the hall. While the nylon loops are all white, they also make colorful chains, resulting in colorful rugs. The staff dye the sock loops to make a rainbow of circles. Sometimes the workers like to make their own patterns when tying loops into a chain, causing the pattern of a rug to be a bit off. To make sure there's an even distribution of color, the staff lay out colored loops in boxes on a circular table. Workers go around the table, picking up a loop from each box. stacking it on a stick.
So when he gets a stick, and these are the old wood slats off of the wood blinds that used to be here when it was a sanatorium, we found a good use for the wood slats. So we take them and we use them then for sticks for them to stack the colored loops on. That way they can keep them in order.
Workers then take the loops from the stick and tie them into the chains. When it's a good sized chain, it's rolled into a ball and taken into the weaving room. Not everyone is a weaver. It takes some serious skill. Only 8 out of 35 weave. I was somewhat shocked to see that they use full-sized looms. About 8 light-colored wooden ones are set up in one half of a large, light room. They face a stage that's back wall is painted with a bright and colorful animal mural. One of the weavers took the time to show me how a rug is made.
What's your name?
I'm Chrissy.
Chrissy, my name's Christina.
That's a pretty name.
It's close.
All right, this is the stick, and you put the colors on here and everything, and then you go and you go and put it through like this, and then you do like that, and then you you change feet and stuff, and you go.
Chrissy
like
is moving
again.
A boat of sorts in between two rows of string. When the chain gets to the other side, she pulls back on an arm, securing the sock rope to the ones before it. Moving her feet on pedals flips the string so that she can move her colorful chain back through to the other side. And the process continues until the rug is the appropriate size. Staff members finish the edges. Of course, you can buy rugs at the BHDC, but you can also get one at one of the many craft fairs in the region. Staff take the rugs and set up shop at places like Spanker Creek and Bella Vista, bringing in over $8,000 just last month. It helps to fund the rugs project and to pay the workers. These rugs are popular. They get custom orders, and I've had 2 on my kitchen floor for the last year.
And of course, they get excited, and when they hear all the praise about their rugs, they like being told what a good job they do and how many rugs we sell. They all go around with puffed up chests, you know, all right. But it makes it nice for them to know they are capable of making something that other people want and are willing to pay for and buy, you know, and so that's encouraging for them.
Another weaver, Harold, was willing to talk to me.
Do you like your job now?
Yeah.
What do you like about it?
I love it.
For more information on the Rugs Project and the Boonville Human Development Center, contact Debbie Hill at deborah.hill@arkansas.gov. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Later today on This American Life, growing up in Minnesota, John says that nobody ever talked about the war that happened near his hometown, Mankato, or the mass execution there.
The place where that hanging happened, I would have hung out at the mall not far from there, a few blocks down the street. I would have ridden past that spot on my way to, you know, Pizza Hut with my buddies.
For Thanksgiving, a story of Indians and settlers later today.
This American Life just ahead this morning at 10 o'clock here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Physical education for students at Bentonville schools soon will be a bit more physical. That's because a new bicycling program tied to PE classes will debut in the district. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis spoke with Mary Lay, the Director of Communications and Public Relations for the Bentonville School District. She says that a key portion of the program was acquiring bikes for individual schools within the district.
Well, we were able to buy 540 bikes, 30 for each school, a classroom set for each school. And we'll start with every elementary, and third and fourth grade will have it, and they will ride a committed amount of 40 hours of biking a year at least, or they could do more. And then the middle school will also have it and have larger bikes for those kids. And they also have to learn bike safety. That'll be part of the program, bike etiquette, trail etiquette, and about the trails. We even wrote our own manual, and the Bentonville Parks Department helped us with the manual. And then so did the Ozark Bike Coalition helped us. It has all the new Razorback Greenway trails, and they have maps of each trail, and they have pictures of the art for Crystal Bridges Trail, and they learn about the different trails and how to ride to school more so their parents have to drive less. And anyway, they'll learn the right-hand signals and how to stop, and how to look, how to pass. And then junior high will also have a set of bikes. And then the new junior high will even have a set of bikes. And then the high school will have it through their intramural program so that there'll be mountain biking for girls and mountain biking for boys. There'll be co-ed mountain biking. So those will be intramural things that we're offering for our large high school.
Where did the idea for this program come from?
Well, kind of me. I like bikes, and, you know, when you do a lot of research on Arkansas, American League of Bicyclists ranked us the 50th least friendly bike state, and that bothered me. And the rankings of obesity bother me. And then we have a wonderful school foundation here who had given a set of bikes already to Lincoln Junior High, and we've seen the kids ride them every day and just loving it and feeling great about it. And then my husband just retired from working for the International Olympics in the sport of triathlon, and he is now the outreach director for Bike Bentonville. So he's into the bikes, and with all the new trails here in Bentonville and the Razorback Greenway, it just makes sense to use the trails as an outside classroom.
So this is kind of a personal mission for you then?
Well, sort of. I'm an avid cyclist myself and runner and triathlete type person, and it just meant a lot to me in my life. And it's non-generational. You know, we have the bikes here in a warehouse now, and we're putting them together on the weekends with lots of volunteer help and Fat Tire mechanics, because the bikes came from Fat Tire. They're Trek bikes. They're really nice bikes, aluminum frames with disc wheels. They're really fine quality. And we've had people from the Bella Vista Bicycling Club, and many seniors have come in and helped put hours of putting the bikes together with the mechanics and helping us get them all for this kickoff that we're having on December 3rd in our athletic complex.
You mentioned this program is eventually going to be for students from elementary school through junior high.
Right, and then with our high school being so large, it was hard to incorporate it and saturate the PE department with it. And we have a collegiate level intramural program with an intramural coordinator that we started a year ago, so it fits in really better with our intramural program in the high school.
But even through elementary through junior high, it seems like that's a lot of bikes to get. Has the school district had partners in getting
this
equipment?
Oh, yes. We got a Walton Family Foundation grant, and then we had a percentage of matching funds that were from Coca-Cola. And then our Bentonville Schools Foundation helped. And then Walmart Visitor Center helped. So all those financial streams combined gave us enough financial support. And then Fat Tire Bike also worked with Trek to get a huge discount on the bikes and to get them where they were more affordable. And then we even found out that the Trek corporate office is sending their own national PR people to come to our event. So we're real excited.
Now, you've mentioned this event a couple times. What exactly is going to be happening at this December 3rd kickoff event?
Well, it's going to be fun because, you know, the athletic complex is an indoor football field. So we're going to put all 540 bikes on the field, and we're going to have 30 students from each school stand by the bikes with the principals and the PE teacher and have one big group picture of because so far in the research I've done, and I could be wrong and just missed it, I know that some of our neighboring districts do some biking in the schools, but I haven't found one district that has saturated it in every school and actually made it a real curriculum piece where there's different safety rules and things that are taught. And we had a historian from Rogers Historical Museum actually figured out the history of each trail. Like a slaughter pen used to be a pig slaughtering house, and Mobley Trail was from the apple orchards of the Mobley Farm. And so we're even going to teach history while they're on the bike. So anyway, but back to the event. Sorry, I get so excited. I talk about the whole gamut. But all the people that help support it, Coca-Cola and different companies will come and celebrate watching the kids, and we'll have photo ops with our board and the board foundation, and then the kids are going to ride their bikes back to the school, so that'd be a lot of fun.
Getting the bikes is one thing, but maintaining them is another entirely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we worked that out too. So we have a gateway program where students that find the high school conformity challenging, and through the Arkansas Career Education Department, we started a entrepreneur bike shop program. So we actually have a bike shop in our high school, and 15 of the students there are getting to be trained bike mechanics, so they will actually maintain the fleet through that course.
This program is starting with 540 bikes. How large are you expecting this program to get?
Probably not a lot larger. This will actually give Lincoln Junior High 90 bikes, and they don't care. They'll find space if they have to. They believe in it that much. But, you know, we have a space issue here because of our growth. So we would even have more bikes if we could, but it's a space issue with us right now. I think we'll just be, you know, rotating them through all the PE classes.
So would you say the whole idea of this program is to try to get kids engaged into riding bikes?
Absolutely, and to get them comfortable with the trails and know how they can use the trails to go to school more so parents won't have to drive them to school so often, because many of our trails hook right up to our schools. Because our trails are used a lot now, we want them to be safe on the trails when they pass people and help, you know, with the etiquette piece and to respect our trails. And our trails are so rich in learning opportunities, we want to give them that outdoor classroom as a fun alternative to learning.
All right, Mary, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you for calling, and we appreciate it.
I ride my bicycle to work each day. It's not so far. It's better for me than my car. I wear a helmet that is made of rigid styrofoam.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And with us on the phone is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Becca, welcome back.
Thank you.
Did you have a good holiday?
Had a wonderful holiday. And I am so excited to tell you what you can go do next weekend.
Okay.
I think the weekend of December 1st and 2nd might just be the most wonderful time of the year in Northwest Arkansas.
Wow, okay.
You can shop local artists.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You can get holiday inspiration at about a dozen beautiful houses.
Right.
And there's food scattered all among that.
'Tis the
yummy
season.
How can you go wrong? I got to see one of the homes on the Huntsville Friendship Club tour of homes.
Mm-hmm.
Last week. It's out around Hinesville, and it's featured on this year's tour. And I'm going to go redecorate my entire house.
You were inspired?
I was inspired. Joni Sykes has been a decorator. She has this style where she combines these huge modern paintings and these bold 1970s colors, you know, orange and green and rust, with vintage folk furniture and folk art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gorgeous.
So they're not decorated for the holidays?
They are decorated for the holidays.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But I didn't care about it. Well, that was good, too.
Right.
But I was busy looking at the house. But she has a tree in every room, practically.
Mm.
She has a sock monkey tree. How can you not love a sock monkey tree?
I love a sock monkey tree.
And my other phone's ringing. Y'all ignore that.
Okay.
Here, let's wait till this stops.
Very popular on a Sunday morning.
We'll just wait till it stops.
All right.
Stupid phone.
Well, you're popular. You can't help that.
Are you done yet? Thank you. Okay. She has a sock monkey tree.
I love a sock monkey tree.
It's fabulous. Her home and two others, along with the First Baptist Church of Hinesville, which is where the food's at, will be on show from 1 to 4 o'clock next Sunday, December 2nd.
Excellent.
Tickets are $10 at the door. You can read all about it in What's Up from Friday. Or you can call Lucina Brashears at 738-2123 for more information. It's the Civic Club's big fundraiser for the year.
Now, let me ask you something. Sometimes I will go to somebody's house and they've decorated it in a really interesting and just imaginative way.
Mm-hmm.
I come back just feeling let down because it's like, well, I could never accomplish that. But you seem to be inspired, like, okay, I can take hints from this and do something that I want to do.
Oh, I think that these, because they're not giant, incredible houses,
mm-hmm,
it's a home, and I think it's easier to be inspired that way.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now, the Winter Dreams Tour of Homes, which it was started 14 years ago by the Junior League, has 9 homes in Benton and Washington County this year, and they are giant homes.
Uh-huh.
But even in those, you can find things that you can go home and do.
Okay.
That tour is 11 to 5, also next Sunday, December 2nd, and tickets are $20 at juniorleaguenwa.org.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the inspiration and the food.
Okay.
Here are the art sales. The Little Craft Show is back for its second year, and it's not so little anymore.
Right.
You know, they tried last year in a church space. It's Amber Paradin and Natalie Freeman's brainchild. And they stuffed, I think, 25 crafters into a shoebox.
That's a lot.
And it was great fun, and people came, and now it's grown up to 55 crafters. And it's going to be from 10 to 6 on Saturday at the Fayetteville Town Center.
Okay.
And you can find out more at thelittlecraftshow.com. The Block Street Holiday Art Sale, which has been around forever, this is its 12th year, has also picked up and moved.
Right.
Because Mike Shirky's Good Folk House picked up and quit being the Good Folk House.
Right.
So they are at Parker Hall at Mount Sequoia.
But that's not Block Street.
Well,
it's Mount Sequoia.
I know, but it's the same artist and the same vibe. It'll be okay. And they got to add a couple of people.
Okay.
Because they had a little more room. So they'll have people like Don House, Ezra Dubois, Faye Alter, Marie Demarukas, and some new folks like Denise Lanuti and Sabina Schmidt.
Oh, good.
That will be from 7 to 9 Friday, 10 to 5 Saturday, and noon to 4 Sunday. At Mount Sequoia, Parker Hall is the first building on your left as you enter the retreat center.
I bet they have some signs.
I bet they will, too. Yeah. And the Community Creative Center is having its annual holiday bazaar.
I know about that one.
Yeah, that's always, I've spent some money there in the past.
Oh, that's going to be where my shopping happens. 10 to 4 Saturday and noon to 4 Sunday at Nadine Baum Studios. Pottery, fabric art, sculpture, handmade cards, paintings, and fun, and probably more food.
And, again, all local.
All local. So go out and have fun. Buy presents.
Okay.
Sounds good. Thank you, Becca.
Thanks, guys.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Your television set will soon have a distinct University of Arkansas influence. Two graduates with Masters of Fine Arts degrees from the University of Arkansas are behind a pair of anticipated series. Ozarks at Large's Katie Henriksen has more.
Two recent graduates of the University of Arkansas program and Creative Writing and Translation MFA program are making waves in the screenwriting business. The program in Creative Writing and Translation was recently named a top-ranked creative writing program by the trade publication Poets and Writers. Nick Pizzolatto, a fiction graduate from 2005, got his break when two of his short stories were published in The Atlantic. And soon after that, his debut novel, Galveston, was published to high acclaim. And it was optioned for film. Pizzolatto decided he wanted to get into film writing, so he began writing for the AMC series The Killing. Though that show is no longer on the air, Pizzolatto is currently in production of a two-year series that he has sold to HBO, starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. The show is called True Detectives, and it's slated to begin airing in 2013. Pizzolatto, who grew up in both New Orleans and Lake Charles, Louisiana, had always wanted to be a storyteller. And he was always drawn to screenwriting. But growing up far from either of the coasts where anything happens in film or television, he wasn't sure how to get there. When I spoke to him via phone from his home outside of LA, he explained the entire process.
I always wanted to be a storyteller and to have an audience for my voice. I suppose, you know, as a kid, like any child of the 20th century who's creative, film and television was very appealing, but there were always these class boundaries, you know, between that industry and what I do. You know, I grew up in South Louisiana, always went to public schools and stuff like that for my college education. And film requires money. It requires that you live on one of the coasts. And most of the people in this industry, you know, generally have Ivy League degrees and stuff like that. So I began as a visual artist and in college transitioned into literature and philosophy. But one of the reasons I gravitated towards prose writing was because I had complete autonomy and it didn't require any sort of capital. You know, if you just have paper and a pen and you're willing to learn and spend the time it takes, you can become a writer. But in 2008, you know, teaching college, and looking at where the world was going, I had decided that with the publication of my novel, Galveston, I was going to try to use that to get a foot in the door in Hollywood. And everything's, you know, been going great since.
And so how were you able to do that? It's just, to me, like, as a person who's never participated at all in that culture, right. how does one make an entry into that crazy world?
Well, you know what I've found, and this is absolutely true in my experience, is that Hollywood is the last meritocracy left. I mean, you can go, I mean, look at me. I went from never working in this industry 2 years ago to now I'm running my own HBO show where I'm the sole writer and executive producer, and I'm writing a movie for Tom Cruise. I mean, is there any industry in the world where a total newcomer can advance that swiftly based on nothing but merit, you know? So the way I got started in it was my novel Galveston got published by Scribner in the summer of 2010. And a film agent who works with my literary agent managed to sell the option for it. And that's not much money, and it doesn't really mean a lot. It just means that, you know, somebody's paying to option your work for a film. But I asked the film agent, you know, what do I have to do to get that screenplay writing job, just because I thought it would be a good way to break in. Because one of the things you need to break into the industry as a writer is lots and lots of samples of screenwriting. You know, the agent said, have you ever written a screenplay? And I said, no. And she said, we have to write screenplays. And then I asked them, well, how do you become, you know, a working television writer? Because it seems like in television, the writer has much more command over the material, and he does. And they said, basically, you needed to write an original pilot that's really great and a spec script, which is a script of an existing show. And that needs to be really great. And if you have those two samples, they can start trying to break me in. So that summer, I think I wrote 7 scripts in like a month and a half. And it created like a lot of noise for me over here. And I had a lot of meetings and with various producers and things like that. So I was flying from Indiana to L.A. quite a bit that summer. And I ended up taking a staffing position on the first season of The Killing for AMC. And HBO gave me a blind pilot deal, which is a set amount of money for a pilot script. And so with those two things, I left my job in academia and moved the family out to L.A. But, you know, that's basically how I broke in.
Sure.
I wrote seven scripts in a month and a half.
That's a lot. Yeah, I think that's usually the trick. It's like
Pizzolatto's True Detectives is slated to begin airing in 2013. He's also working on the remake of the movie Magnificent Seven starring Tom Cruise. Another recent graduate who's broken into the screenwriting business is Tony Toast, a poetry graduate from 2004. He studied and was a colleague of Nick Pizzolatto's. Toast's first book of poetry, Invisible Bride, won the prestigious Walt Whitman Award while he was still studying at the University of Arkansas. He later went on to publish another book of poetry, as well as a book of music criticism on Johnny Cash. He decided that he really wanted to focus on film, however. Unlike Pizzolatto, Toast does not live in L.A. He lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but he has been writing for the TV series Longmire and is shopping television ideas right now. I was curious to find out about the transition from writing poetry to writing screenplays.
But in terms of like translating like skills from poetry to screenwriting, there's more kind of overlap than I think you'd imagine, because like I think like especially in modern poetry, the image is the often the meaning making unit in a poem. Yeah, I might be a little old school in that, and the old William Carlos Williams, like, you know, provide a series of charged images, and then the mind will begin deriving emotions and making sense of those. And screenplays a little bit like that. You're trying to stage, structure images, scenes, even with as little dialogue as possible, that make a kind of emotional, dramatic sense. And I think poetry was a good testing ground for that. Also, for getting a sense of having an ear for the sound of words aloud, since you have to read your work with some kind and have it hopefully have some kind of rhythmic authority. That kind of sense of the externality of language. So that's something I think, like, I'm kind of lucky that I didn't do fiction first, because even though I probably could have used a lot more practice on narrative structure, I never had the sense of internalized narrative and self-monologues going on that I think a lot of fiction rightly relies upon it. And so jumping into screenwriting, script writing, where everything has to be externalized, I didn't have to travel as far or shed as many habits that maybe somebody who'd been writing fiction for 10, 15 years would have to shed. And so in that way, it was a good training ground.
I'll be the first to admit that I don't watch TV all that often. So I wanted to find out from Toast exactly what Longmire was all about.
Longmire is a very cool, I think, show that just finished up its first season this summer on A&E. It's a pretty big success, I think. It got renewed for a second season. It's pulled in kind of the biggest numbers that A&E's had for a drama so far. And it's about a widowed sheriff, about 50 years old, in rural Wyoming. And he's got this big, vast county that he oversees, and it's adjacent to an Indian reservation. And there's a kind of, it really has, it's interesting because it's it melds a little bit. It's from the people who did The Closer. The executive producers all worked on The Closer and helped create that. And so there's that sense of a, if you're familiar with The Closer, there's a procedural, like, crime of the week element, but it's also much more character-based and psychologically curious about its characters and its crimes than maybe your the network version of a procedural, the cable version. So there, it melds that kind of template with a lot of the iconography of your traditional Western. So the Walt Longmire, the sheriff, he looks like he just stepped out of Gunsmoke a little bit. He's kind of old-fashioned in his technologies. His best friend is a Cheyenne Indian who runs basically a modern saloon, and so you have a lot of the tropes, the imagery of the traditional Western, but it very much the show and the executive producers, the writers are all very interested in kind of pushing, like, seeing what kind of getting in under the surface of these tropes, these kind of traditional American ideals, and to see what's kind of lurking underneath them. And so I think it really kind of had a really good first season of it.
Since Toast wrote as a freelancer for Longmire, he's not sure how much he'll be writing for the season as it continues, but he's currently shopping television ideas. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large, and a pair of our stories today dealt with healthcare, and that has inspired this morning's montage. Fictional doctors, songs about doctors, see how many you can name, and to be fair, we have used the title of doctor very widely. Physicians, scientists, and academics. Here we go. A pop culture tribute to people and things called doctor.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna kill my ill. I got a bad case of loving you.
Is that what Bill thought was wrong?
That's what Kovac led him to believe.
That doesn't quite make sense. Why would he bother to make a house call?
You didn't call him, did you?
Oh, no, I called you.
Well, then he must have felt some concern.
Are you the poet?
Yes.
I used to admire your poetry.
Thank you.
I shouldn't admire it now. I should find it absurdly personal. Don't you agree? Feelings, insights, affections, it's suddenly trivial now. You don't agree. You're wrong. The personal life is dead in Russia. History has killed it. I can see how you might hate me.
I hate everything you say, but not enough to kill you for it.
Hell out of there, kid!
Let go!
Walsh, come on, grab this idiot, will you?
Get your hands off me!
You want to go to jail?
No, you'll be going to jail for criminal negligence. This man has a dislocated fracture of the femur, and he's going to lose his leg unless I fix it right away.
Dr. Lecter, my name is Clarice Starling. May I speak with you?
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
Can I stop now?
If you want to.
It will not affect this.
Affect this? Oh, it's a yo-yo. It's a game. I thought you would enjoy it.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done
my 10 references. How many could you name? You can go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com, to see the full list.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 25th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of Andrew Carnegie, born in Dunfermline, Scotland, 1835. Grew up poor, worked as a mill hand, came to this country when he was 13, went into the steel business, helped to build the American steel industry, and became one of the richest entrepreneurs of his time. Andrew Carnegie was afraid that the pursuit of wealth would degrade him. So he sold his steel business and gave his fortune away. He endowed 2,811 libraries. He established the Carnegie Endowment, and he bought more than 7,000 organs for churches to, in his words, lessen the pain of the sermons. It's the birthday of Joe DiMaggio, born Martinez, California, 1914, who hit safely in 56 consecutive games in 1941, one of the great feats in the history of baseball. It's the birthday of Helen Hooven Santmeyer, Cincinnati, 1895. Grew up in a little town of Xenia, Ohio. Went off to New York. She was a secretary for Scribner's Magazine. Then moved back to Xenia. She wrote an epic novel about a small-town women's group based on her own women's club of Xenia, Ohio. The book was called And Ladies of the Club. It came out when she was 87 years old, Helen Hooven Santmeyer. It was more than 1,300 pages long, and it went straight to number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And it's the birthday of the physician and essayist Lewis Thomas, born Flushing, New York, 1913. Went to Princeton to study biology and also poetry. He loved the poetry of Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. Had a big career, became president of the Sloan Kettering Institute, and also started writing informal essays. He wrote them late at night, without an outline, wrote quickly, including no reference notes at the end, writing about the human body, but also philosophy. In 1974, 29 of the essays were collected in The Lives of a Cell, which won the National Book Award. Lewis Thomas, the physician who said, "The great secret of doctors, known only to their wives, but still hidden from the public, is that most things get better by themselves. Most things, in fact, are better in the morning." Here's a poem for today by Edward Field entitled "The Telephone." "My happiness depends on an electric appliance, and I do not mind giving it so much credit, with life in the city being what it is, each person separated from friends by a tangle of subways and buses. Yes, my telephone is my joy. It tells me that I am in the world and wanted. It rings and I am alerted to love or gossip. I go comb my hair, which begins to sparkle. Without it, I was like a bear in a cave, drowsing through a shadowy winter. It rings and spring has come. I stretch and amble out into the sunshine, hungry again as I pick up the receiver for the human voice and the good news of friends." The Telephone by Edward Field, from Counting Myself Lucky, published by Black Sparrow Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world. You can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Joy Biles, engineered by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF comes from the New Design School, hosting its Mayan Gala Thursday, December 6th at BHK on the Square in Fayetteville. This event will feature student works, Mayan-inspired food and music, plus local merchandise. Proceeds benefit student scholarships. Visit newdesignschool.org for more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Sugar Beach, Missouri.
Sugar Beach.
Sugar Beach is northeast of Pineville in McDonald County.
Is it on?
I don't think so.
The Elk River or anything?
I don't think so.
Oh.
It might be on a creek. Mm. It's on Big Sugar Creek is what it's on.
Okay. That
so
makes sense.
I'm not sure if it's really a beach. Maybe someone from Sugar Beach can tell us.
Okay. So we've had a few days off with the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any plans this afternoon?
No.
No.
No. I mean, not that I know of.
Okay.
That's okay, though.
All
sometimes
right.
No plan is the best plan.
Right.
You?
Usual Sunday afternoon yoga.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's very calming.
It is calming.
Back to a work week.
Yep. All right. Antoinette Grajeda will be back tomorrow?
No.
I'm
by myself tomorrow.
Okay. All right. Well.
No ill will between us. Just she won't be there.
She won't be there.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
All right. Happy Sunday.